Welcome to For the Record, an unfiltered view on current trends and timeless advice for surviving in the aesthetics industry. Whether you're an injector, practice owner, sales rep, or marketer, it's time to set the record straight. Each week, we'll cut through the chaos and showcase diverse perspectives and winning ideas from the best minds in the industry. I'm your host, Dr. Tiffany Lopez, Chief Growth Officer at Aesthetic Record. And now, let's get started on this week's episode. Welcome back to another episode of For the Record. I'm your host, Tiffany Lopez, Chief Growth Officer at Aesthetic Record. And today we have a in-studio guest. So since post-COVID, we've had a lot of virtual guests, but here today in the flesh. So we have an exciting, hopefully, hour of dialogue to follow this. But we have with us Dr. Justin Harper, who is my boss, our CEO at Aesthetic Record, and also the CEO of Jubilee Aesthetics. You also do advising on technology, on the patient experience, on business, on FDA approvals and trials, currently doing some skincare research, amongst other things. And I think a few articles will be published soon from some previous research. So a busy dude, but took time out to come here with us today in Dallas and talk about all things aesthetics. And so as we built this podcast, we talked about disruptive thinkers, people who are really innovative and do kind of crazy off the wall things. And I think that you fit the bill.
That's probably true. Yeah,
I bet. Sometimes too much, maybe.
For sure.
But we're going to go ahead and get started and go through quite a bit of stuff today. We're going to talk about just the aesthetics market in general, about Jubilee Aesthetics, your practice, about AR, and really what's to come as we look at our future in the next maybe 5 years in our industry. So we'll go ahead and get started and tell us a little bit about, just as a softball question here, how did you get started in aesthetics?
I got started in aesthetics through a pretty unconventional path. So my original residency was in plastic surgery at Ohio State. And I was in that program for about 3 years before I re-entered the match and switched to dermatology residency. Pretty unconventional, but was looking at surgery as always having an important need, but maybe not being in the future of kind of the way things were trending. Dermatology did some time in allergic contact dermatitis fellowship. So I still like skincare products and ingredients. And then did traditional medical dermatology in that residency program at Ohio State as well, before starting the practice actually as a resident. So kind of worked with my program director and had a permission to do so and started Jubilee up and quickly became very busy with that and continued to grow and scale from there.
So thinking about plastic surgery, for those of you who are listening, you know, I think about if you're a surgeon, you can treat one patient at a time. Right? There's not a lot of scale there. Obviously, med spas are more of a scale game. So as you think about your preferred method of building the med spa versus the others, especially Jubilee in general, what's the biggest thing you can tell us about the decision to go with scale?
I think it was really a couple of different reasons why I chose to do that. One, it was interesting. So it hadn't really been done a lot or hadn't been done, you know, extensively. So the other part of it was wanting to be able to do, I have some interests obviously in business, some in technology and building things. And what I realized with working with, you know, surgeons, and nothing wrong with it, it's actually a great thing to do, but you can only be one person. You can only get as big as one person can be. And so really your own hours of the day, not unlike everybody else, really limits your ability to have an impact or influence. But you are capped out at what you're able to personally do with your own hands. And so for me, looking at really where I wanted to make impact and what I wanted to accomplish, it wasn't feasible as a single person doing that type of work.
And in traditional fashion, again, as a disruptor, you didn't decide to do one. You decided to do lots of them, like two handfuls of them. So certainly Jubilee has grown quickly. And tell us when it started. When did you first start the Jubilee first practice?
It's kind of an interesting question. Depends on when you count starting. So started actually 2012, 2013, knowing that I wanted to build like a scalable model, acquired some real estate and started to renovate the real estate in order to kind of have a foundation or maybe a testing ground where I would be able to change and iterate and try to figure out what was the best version of how I wanted to operate. And then I didn't start seeing patients until, I guess, the very, very end of 2014. I kind of considered just the beginning of 2015 for the most part. And so from 2015 on, much more consistently.
And so we'll talk about this in a little bit, but obviously COVID had some impact there. So you are at 12 practices now, making decisions to maybe not open a few or merge patient lists together and things. So we'll get to that in just a second. But as you think about scale and growing quite quickly in 5 years, there's lots of things that could go wrong, right? Lots of things that can go right, but many that can go wrong as well. And so from an HR perspective, you've obviously hired, trained, developed a lot of injectors, a lot of office admin, you know, people in general. But from a trainer to injector standpoint, walk us through kind of that whole process of what things you do to protect yourself, to protect the practice, as you're giving away your intellectual property the Juvly way, basically.
Yeah, so I think as you scale, especially if you're going to scale quickly, you're making as many mistakes as you are getting things right. And I think it's really just a resiliency factor that gets you through enough of them, or to survive enough of them, to learn to maybe not do everything perfectly, but to at least not make that same mistake again. And so admittedly, when I started on the training side, I didn't realize, you know, somewhat new to the industry overall, although kind of seeing that it had grown a lot and having some experience doing the treatments myself, I was pretty naive on the actual business side of it, in the very specific ramifications. So a lot of the recommendations that I followed, or a lot of, you know, the advice that I was given, if you were to ask me if I think that advice is still good or true, I would probably say it's almost uniformly or almost completely wrong. And many of the problems that have had to go through, or challenges to like learn or overcome, really came from some of those foundational problems that were created. And I think that that's kind of the difficulty when you're starting something. As you lay your foundation, you can't do it perfect, but you're going to carry those issues with you until you address them. When you scale quickly, you scale the size of those issues with you at the same time. And the fix is no easier when you're big than it is small. In most cases, it's actually way worse, because it has a much bigger impact globally or collectively. So getting back to the original question, though, in terms of protecting your intellectual property and kind of devoting and dedicating your time into developing others, I think that is probably the key question of the future of aesthetics. I think that that is the one fundamental challenge that very few have ever been able to solve. And I think there are two general approaches. One, you can just not do it, and then you're somewhat pigeonholing yourself into being, again, a single individual, as busy as you can be, but never really being able to kind of do more than that. And not just from a revenue, productivity, how much volume can I do? There's a lot of satisfaction, a lot of growth, I think, that comes from working in larger groups and contributing to an overall larger team. I think when you have more people and more volume or scale working collectively, you can also do things that are a little bit harder to achieve from these types of businesses. So, you know, being able to employ somebody in a fashion that they can actually use this as a career, rather than having it be like a side job, or, you know, this part-time thing that they're doing in addition to something else. But I think you progressively learn how to protect that little by little over time. A lot of it is setting expectations up front. Maybe the biggest part of it is just not hiring the people who you've learned are going to be problems in the future. And I tend not to hire anyone who is coming from a different practice with that same story. So, you know, historically, I would say that a lot of the techniques that existed just technically were not very good, and they are getting much, much better. And so our collective skill as an industry is improving. The accessibility to training is improving. And so you do get more and more people out there with experience who have what I would consider effective or useful experience. However, if somebody comes from a situation where they were at a practice, they're looking for, you know, the grass is always greener kind of situation, and they, especially if they offer to bring patients or do anything like that, I've never hired anyone like that, and I just choose not to. I would say that past behavior is always going to tell you how they're going to act in the future, and somebody who is always kind of looking for that next thing is always going to be that same person. So unfortunately or fortunately, as you go through it, you learn what I consider red flags. You learn things that are more consistent with somebody who's going to give you trouble, and things that are lead to success more commonly. And unfortunately, it's as painful every single time as it is the first time, for the most part. Dealing with the legal side of things, if you have no contracts, no employment agreements, no expectations, no rules around social, no rules around patient contact, I mean, you can still take all the actions you want. That's the interesting thing about the legal system, is it doesn't really matter whether you're right or wrong. You can always sue anyone at any time for any reason, and you can create pain all around. However, being prepared in those different avenues or venues greatly avoids that. It also sets initial conversations up to be along the appropriate lines. The goal is to hire and find people whose goals and intentions match your goals and intentions and what you're able to achieve together. And then, you know, little by little, it gets to be better. And then you're always surprised. There's always somebody who you didn't think was going to be that way who does it. And so you always want to be smart and protect your records, protect your login information. Make sure that I always say, don't save a dollar to lose a thousand. Don't use pretend things. So make sure, you know, if you will use software and logins, and since it's something I'm very familiar with, don't share a login amongst 10 people when you're going to need to be able to track the user behavior of that individual at any given time. Not only is it a security risk, but from a protection of your what you built risk, it's just not worth it. Use professional systems. I think as long as, you know, you don't treat your own business in kind of a homemade or not real kind of pieced together way, it will always behave as such.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to say about all that. I could go in so many different directions, but yeah, I think from the one point that you mentioned is be prepared. And, you know, as I talk to practices all the time, because I do get a lot of, you know, phone calls and things with the software, they have no idea how to protect themselves from, you know, I had an account this past week. They're paying someone to do Instagram under their personal, not the company's Instagram. So they're building someone else's brand, but not their company's brand. But I think to your point, having things in place preemptively is important. We had Crystal on from Of Me, and she talked a lot about culture and job fit and personality fit and sort of the warmer subjective part of the business. What you're talking about is more of the objective. Is it pass the sniff test or not legally? So I think non-compete, non-solicitation, there's a lot of things there that we could certainly go into and places we could go. But from that perspective, one of the things that, you know, as you think about being burned and such and hiring rock stars, one thing that you did that's very different in the industry is Juvly does not bear your name anywhere. It's not really anywhere but on the door to say that you're the medical director. What made you choose to, in a sense, take your own advice and not make yourself sort of the icon of the practice or tie it to your personal brand in a bigger way?
I know it's somewhat controversial, and it's I think very tempting to do, especially early on. And I would say that early on it was much more common than it is now. And I think at a certain point, a certain size and scale, it actually becomes important again. So you have to then rebuild your brand. So it's like you selectively or intentionally care about your brand, your personal brand, at different points. And so early on, when there's nothing else, your personal brand may carry more weight than your company brand. And you need to get exposure, and you need people to recognize you, and you're going to be getting reviews and doing these different things. And in many cases, in many cases, it's going to fall on your own personal brand. Should you not brand yourself? I think it really depends. So if the practice that you're hoping to build, or the profession you're trying to build, is of, I want everybody to know my name, I want to be recognized, I want to be the destination that people go to, then I think that you should do that. You should brand yourself, and you should use every opportunity to do so. And this company brand is probably a secondary, maybe even a distraction from your intended goal. If in contrast, you're trying to build a brand or a business like was my intention, then you use your own personal brand for a period of time until you can transition that to a company brand. And then I think it's really tempting to want to reinsert yourself at all, every different point along the way, but it becomes very, very difficult for that to be a real brand, because there's always a competing, hey, I want to go to this place, but I don't actually want to go to that place. I just actually want to go to that person. And if you always have to like play a game of one-upsomanship, right? If somebody on my team posts something and I post something even better and I put your name and my name, then it becomes almost like an internal competition. Internal competition, if it's, you know, well-intentioned, is fine, and it's actually probably very productive. However, if it's very competitive or meant to kind of put somebody down, I think it's counterproductive. Getting to the final, where you may want to build up your personal brand again, is at a certain point, if you want to do research and you want to contribute and you want to participate in other parts of improving your own business, if nobody knows who you are, then it's difficult to do so. And so I think you have to intentionally or carefully always continue to build your brand at that point, but always kind of point it back at the end of the day, because even building your personal brand at that moment is still designed or intended to build to kind of funnel it back towards the brand you're creating.
It's definitely one leads the other. I also think about an exit strategy. If your name is on it and only your name, You're sort of a prisoner to it forever. You can never leave, because if you ever leave, then it has to take on a new identity and it's no longer the same intangible value. So I think it was a good choice personally.
Cool. Yeah, we'll see. It was always, as a young, like just starting out plastic surgery resident, you would hear from plastic surgeons or you know, people towards the end of their career who were trying to sell their practice. And there used to be this thing called goodwill, where a practice valuation was somewhat, not just on the revenue that you would generate, but on this this sliding scale, something called goodwill, that patients will inherently or naturally go back to the practice, not because of the person, but just there's this goodwill with the practice. And there's probably some of that. However, if you look at it now, I think goodwill plays into valuations very little. And particularly if it's like a named practice, name famous person who didn't, like, before they retired, have like this new successor take over and build up that brand, it's really hard to have somebody purchase that for any amount of real revenue or value, because we always inherently overvalue our own contribution. And so we think that it's worth who knows crazy numbers, when in reality, to somebody who's acquiring it, they're acquiring it either to make their marketing easier or because there's some recurring or fixed revenue that they can shortcut or shortchange their own building of that. So, you know, but I think that's what people are looking at, is when they're trying to determine what they would pay for something like that.
We're going to sort of finish this section up and move on to a different topic, but I wanted to end it with to that same idea. I know that you're very committed to, as I am. If you've ever seen me lecture, I talk about SOPs nonstop. You guys have heard it too on the podcast several times, but I know that you do things the Juvly way. It's very much ingrained in who you are as a company. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the scale in your business is because you've adopted this way, and it's like, this is what you do it. Walk us through a little bit for someone who's starting a business, thinking about that for themselves. They have, you know, Sally doing it one way, Joe doing it one way, you're doing it a different way. What does that bring to the practice to really define the SOPs, to really coach to them and enforce them? And how does that pay off with this long term? Because it is a pain to do, right? In the beginning, it's a lot to build.
Yeah. Well, I think the hardest part of it is that anything that people are going to do consistently has to be repeated, and you have to uphold it and you have to reinforce it, you know, often more times than you want to, and you have to be consistent to it. And so, you know, I like to train and then retrain and retrain again. And so I think that that's where people underestimate the amount of time and effort and dedication that goes into having SOPs. Now, on the other side of that, if you don't have them, it's just pure chaos. And not only that, but it actually hurts your brand. It makes your brand internally not cohesive at all. So had the experience of acquiring practices, and some of the people in the practice came with their own style. And it's somewhat controversial, but I think that in the end of the day, I would be happy to change everything that I do as soon as I see a better way. And so it's not about picking something and then never changing as things evolve, because as we've all seen, products, treatments, treatment modalities, new novel things, you know, everything, even beauty norms, shift. And so I think at the end of the day, you can have a very productive conversation that's always up for grabs. So in our world, I'm happy to consider anything that anybody's going to do better. And the evaluation process of that just needs to be systematic. It can't be based on, I like this because I feel that it's better. If it's actually better, then we should be able to prove that it's better. And as much art and creativity as there is in this world, there's still foundational principles in science. And at the end of the day, there should be some determination as to, is it actually better, yes or no? And if it is, then including myself, we should adopt it and go back to having a single standard again. So I've just seen too often where even in a single company that has even a single location for that matter, it's like there's this style and then there's this style. And so it's almost like people are choosing from a menu, almost like a tattoo parlor where somebody's going to look at, I do this kind of art or this kind of art. They're not going to the location knowing what they do. They're going and they're trying to search out or seek out who does it within that small group or within those locations exactly how I want to have it done. And it's difficult to bring new people into that because then there's nothing for them to learn, right? It's learning something and then they go to the person, the other expert who does it exactly a different way and says that everything that this expert did is wrong. I think there's a time and a place to challenge the way you do things. And there's a time and a place to challenge somebody's understanding of what they think they know. And somebody who's super comfortable and confident should be able to entertain any technique, any idea, and see or understand the pros and the cons, maybe even make a trade-off as to why they treat the way they do. But I think it takes a ton of time and a lot of discipline to maintain that. And eventually, though, it does pay off in the sense that then you know what to do. You have a way that people can be trained. You have a way that people can be onboarded. And most importantly, if that is an adaptable standard, then theoretically you're getting better and better and better collectively rather than having some people staying the same and others not advancing. It also helps with turnover like we talked about earlier. And it's kind of interesting. It's always kind of a little bit humorous for me when somebody comes in and when they went to see somebody who's no longer with the practice and they're like, I'm just so sad because that person just did my lips so well. And you're like, did you know that every other person here does them exactly the same way? And that doesn't mean there's only one style and one way to do it, but we all have the same training. We all have learned the same way of doing it. And while there is a difference in really the time that somebody's been with their practice and how long they've had to work on their skills, but at the end of the day, there's not going to be some tightly held secret in one of the practices that the other people aren't going to know or be able to reproduce.
I think it's super important. You know, I always kind of think in my mind that a specialist is the enemy of scale, right? If someone specializes in this one thing, you're a prisoner to their schedule, their vacation days, their client list. Because if only, you know, Susie can do it this way, then if Susie, to your point, leaves, you know, you're kind of out, hung out to dry. So now we're going to move on to COVID, which has basically destroyed many of our lives for a couple months. We were all shut down. You were shut down for a few months. At Aesthetic Record, we were crazy busy because people were shut down thinking about their business and making it leaner and more profitable. So it's been a very chaotic time for all of us. But you had to make the decision to close down clinics and then to reopen them as we came back. So give us a bit of an idea of your decision-making process in coming back, which ones were opened and when, and just sort of an overview of that whole part. We'll start there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think to say that it was a surprise or to catch us off guard is like an understatement. We knew that something was coming. We knew people were starting to have increasing levels of panic around this and then, you know, started to see some like very abrupt changes. So we had really less than 24 hours to close. I think we canceled something like 2,000 appointments the next morning. And the math of many practices, a lot of payroll that still has to be paid out from full productivity, essentially all bills coming due still, and rent, as I'm sure many people have experienced, it's not unique. Interesting, a lot of problems favor scale, so that you're better equipped to deal with them if you have scale. And others are like perfectly designed against scale. And COVID might be perfectly designed against scale because the bigger you are, thinking about recessions and downturns, they typically don't happen instantly. And so even as you wind down, you have the ability to kind of downsize a little bit and start paring back. COVID was not that way. So we just had to close, period. And, you know, when you go from having pretty high levels of revenue to zero revenue or next to zero revenue, I think the initial lesson that has served me well for a lot of years is you don't have to respond to anything at that moment. So if you were to ask me March 18th or March 20th, right, 2 days into being closed, how is everything going to work out? How was I going to make rent? How was I going to pay all of those bills? I don't think anybody has enough resources just lying around for, you know, at least I hope not, like quarters of like zero revenue. That's not like a normal use case for businesses typically. Now, you can be much leaner and you can have everything paid for. And, you know, there's a lot of financial health that you can, you know, amass or build beforehand. But I think that it really was unclear exactly how to make everything work. So I think the initial lesson for me that has served me well before and did work out pretty well again is, you know, just know that you'll have some time, right? Nothing is instant. And so I think too many rash decisions kind of, it's impossible to make them all perfectly. And while, you know, making decisions during difficult times is never a perfect situation, I think that a little bit of patience and almost holding yourself back to kind of watch things work out and start to assess what's going on, I think is usually a good approach. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't act quickly. So, you know, for me, the number one priority was mitigate damage, right? So I don't know how I'm going to get through all the damage, but I'm going to try to mitigate it now. So we made decisions very early on, whether like instantly, whether we were going to be able to furlough, lay off, close, open, and how we were going to approach it, because every day that went past of figuring some of that out only made the problems worse. And so, you know, for me, the urgency was only in, let me limit the damage, very much like a trauma mentality. Let me stop the injury and then I can figure out what it is and then I can deal with it. So, coming out of it, though, we had to make a lot of difficult decisions. But again, not all of those had to be made up front. And whether an office would reopen or not reopen, I think one of the many surprising things about COVID for me was the difference in perspective that each individual had on the situation. So you learned things about people that you would have never known or learned about otherwise. Some people who you didn't expect were deathly afraid of the whole situation. And then others were almost like not afraid enough. Some people decided to relocate. Some people decided to reevaluate their lives. Some people, who knows what they decided to do during that period of time, because everybody was under stress, and how everybody deals with stress is highly variable. I would think, though, is it also showed, and sometimes surprising, who had built up their own resiliency, who had a level of maturity in dealing with difficult things that not everybody did. For many, the response was really varied. And what it showed is, you know, some people needed to reevaluate some things. Some people's perception on what was happening was really interesting. Some were really extreme and some were not. Some people's understanding of business and business economics was like surprisingly not accurate. Understanding, you know, at the end of the day, most of us are somewhat of a cash-based business. You know, we don't have, you know, months and months and months of money outstanding that's still coming in, and just how practice economics works helped me to realize that I may need to make sure that people have at least a baseline understanding of how financials work and all of that. But the difference in people in HR was probably the single largest surprise about COVID. Now, that led to other interesting or complicated questions. So, you know, we had teams of people to do things before, and we had a lot of admin support and practice support and people who checked people in and doing all these different things. And we've always been a heavy user of technology, and we've always used technology to automate and kind of work with us so that we don't have, you know, me, for example, I don't work with an assistant. I do my own charting. I do my own checking out in the room, which I know sounds crazy to many, but doing the math, the amount of the extra minute it takes me to do it does not justify a salary of somebody to do that instead. That aside, we were really heavily staffed, and we knew that we were heavily staffed in some ways because of the growth cycle. And so growing at such a rapid pace, we were always intentionally staffing up. But as we started to evaluate a lot of things, I took kind of an opposite approach. I want to say, okay, as we start to eliminate some of these teams and we have no choice, it gave us somewhat of a unique position and really, as a practice owner, we got to look into each and every detail of our business because we had time to do so at a very, very deep and fine level. And I think that that's kind of a useful exercise that hopefully I can think about some ways to recreate it in the future. But as you started to go through each role, each position, each work product, you started to see that the collective work that was being done really didn't justify the teams that it had around it. And so I took an extremely lean method for restaffing. So as we came back, you know, we were working with 10%, 20% of our original staff, still doing pretty well and trying to keep up. And I think that I think when you're dealing with innovation or in change, it's really uncomfortable by nature. And I find that a lot of people like to get away from that comfort get away from that discomfort as quickly as possible. And I think that most of the growth and most of the actual innovation comes when you don't allow yourself to leave the discomfort and you decide to push through to that next level. So we started experimenting with a bunch of different things that we had intended to get to, but we hadn't. New levels of automation, new levels of using technology as resources. You know, as an aesthetic record platform, you know, we made tremendous changes and enhancements throughout COVID to better enable it. And we kind of leveraged those to the max to be able to come back with a very small fraction of the staff and still be able to service the patients extremely well. We also decided offices where we had too many offices in a small geographic footprint that we collapsed one of them into. So we took three down to two. And we had one that was more of a temporary thing. We decided not to continue that. When it came to staffing, I believe that skill is very highly associated with full effort. And somewhat reluctantly was convinced to try some experiments with part-time or part-time people. And I just don't fundamentally believe in that. So we decided to not hire back people at a part-time level that were going to require full-time effort into staffing or training them. And I think it's very different when you have somebody who can come in as a part-time person and requires part-time effort, right? Somebody highly skilled, somebody who can really contribute. That's extremely different than taking two people who you're going to have to dedicate the same amount of time, but only get a day a week out of one person, or have the potential of working with the other person 5 days a week. And so we really challenged a lot of, you know, what we held. And I guess I'm even surprised somewhat myself, which, you know, I'm very optimistic. I always have big ideas and big goals. And this one, we've really been able to change and innovate in a way that I'll actually end up being very thankful for COVID and having to make some hard choices and having time. But I think that it's a great time for change. And I don't think that I think we still have two directions. As COVID lifts more and more, as we see more and more people, we always have the opportunity to go back to the path we were on. And it's interesting because some people on all of our teams are like desperately waiting for that minute. And I've even had to have conversations with some people who I brought back who were just saying, when are we going to be back there? And I said, well, unfortunately, we're never going to be back there. And so since we're never going to be back there and we're going to be not worse, definitely better, but a different kind of better, then maybe it might not be a good fit. So continue to kind of reinforce that change moving forward. But COVID's been interesting to say the least. a lot of bad, but I think in the end, actually mostly good.
You know, I think too, it depends on your model. So obviously Jubilee is a bit of a different model than maybe a high touch concierge type practice. And, you know, I think as I look at COVID, we thought patients cared about all this stuff. You know, we thought they cared about the selfie wall and the aroma in the practices. And did you get a coffee or water when you walked in the front door? And I think we're finding out that patients just want to be treated. Get in, get out, be quick. They don't need all the fluff that we tend to spend a lot of time on in our industry. So I think there's going to be, I think the patient experience has changed because the patients are driving it too, not just the practices. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, to your point, it's been a great levelizer, if you will. If you were good at business and resilient, you could survive. If not, you didn't. Mm-hmm. But also bringing people back. So I think we're seeing a lot of people who are choosing to not bring back employees, or they're using this time to say they weren't really a great fit for us anyway. We're going to go ahead and let them go. But to your point, what I'm hearing people say now is they're going back. We're going back to pre-COVID. So odd lessons that we learned that we so painfully all lived through have now been sort of tossed to the wayside, and they're going to go back to where they were in February, March.
I think the industry did tremendously well as a whole. I think industry partners, while they had to think through how they were going to support the industry, and while their quarter numbers, I'm sure, were not pleasant, they also saved a lot, right? They had a lot less, you know, people traveling. They were doing less conferences. They had time to, very similar to we did, they had time to reevaluate their strategy, look at things that were working and things that weren't. We got new products. We had new product launches that were very successful. And patient consumption of media skyrocketed. And so patients became more and more interested with things. They were looking at themselves more in Zoom and otherwise. And so the demand across the board, even if financially it isn't totally viable, I think the interest actually went up quite a lot. Now, what's interesting as we talk to patients is somewhat of a marker of how economically the world is. I think collectively, economically, we're far worse off than we think long term. Patients have always had a choice, but as financially they're challenged in some ways, as all of this economically sorts itself out for probably some time, I think it's going to be really important. But I think that we will have a large group of patients who are doing better than ever. So the people who are in digital businesses who are able to do more and their businesses are thriving. You know, if you imagine, you know, if you work at Zoom or Facebook or some of these places.
Or Aesthetic Record, frankly.
Or Aesthetic
we were
Record.
So busy.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting going into it. You know, we're like, what's going to happen in some ways? But again, not worried about what was going to happen, but what can we do now? We worked on telemedicine. We knew that we needed to have more digital. Even though we were heavy digital cloud-based, we wanted to be even more so. Like the no-touch protocol and that kind of stuff that we worked on, I think kept me from wondering about the future of Aesthetic Record other than just providing hopefully the tools that we needed at the time to help us get through. And so many people are not consuming. They're not going out to eat. They're not going out to social events. And while you could argue that they don't need to or want to look good because they're not doing those things, I haven't seen that to be true. You know, there's just as much demand as ever. And so I think hopefully most of us are actually smarter, though. So we're going to build our businesses back up a little more carefully, more intentionally. For me, being crazy excited about all growth and all scale, and that growth and scale kind of somewhat fixing itself, very interested in growing and scaling again, but definitely taking some of those lessons forward. So I don't think we'll ever grow and scale the same way. We'll grow and scale, hopefully even way better.
I think it's interesting to think about Aesthetic Record because as we kind of end this, you know, end our time together here, we were crazy busy during COVID. I, for one, didn't believe it would last as long as it did. Mm-hmm. You knew it was going to last and kept telling me it was going to last indefinitely. And so we had a lot of decisions to make. We luckily were able to hire more staff and keep things going and really help, I think, a lot of people during COVID. We did a lot of consulting work with practices, helped them with their operations and getting them moved over. So we were insanely busy. And to your point, digital companies tend to obviously thrive in this environment. But looking forward, you know, even past AR, because many of our listeners here know our business quite well, we had this little thing called a conference in the middle of all this, Aesthetic Next. Mm-hmm. And so you obviously direct the clinical part of our conference. I do more of the overall event management. And we had that happening at the same time. So we were trying to manage a conference, Aesthetic Record. You had Juvelee. It was a bit of a chaotic time. But emerging from that, I think we're all hopefully better for it. But in that regard, thinking about patients and, you know, just from patient experience, I believe firmly that a lot of people have nowhere to take out their anger, their sadness, what's happening, the change in the world. Mm-hmm. And they take it out on us, either as AR people, you as a provider, however that works. Can you give us just a quick, you know, quick overview of how the patient experience has changed for you, or even with colleagues, even with your employees, and how we kind of think about that going forward to the intellectual or emotional intelligence component of it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I read an article and I don't remember where it was, but I believe it was probably Harvard Business Review. And it said there's no such thing as unaffected. So whether you were displaced from employment or not, or whether you were actually sick or had a loved one or a family member sick or die or any of those things, that everybody is somewhat affected. Even the people who are doing better than they've ever done, that everybody's affected. And, you know, we've always historically seen this around holidays, right? So it's our busiest time of the year, but the emotions are, you know, through the roof. And so it's, you know, we kind of always like talk to one another about like, we've got to survive the fall, right? We have to survive holiday season. And not only are we stressed and trying to split our time and trying to visit family and trying to do all of that, but so are the patients. And I would say, you know, it's been interesting this year for us on many facets, but even with the conference, which is something that I really enjoy. And, you know, for me, it was always about bringing, I care so much about training and people being good at things that it, for me, it was always about bringing people who are really the best in the world at things and sharing that so we can all get better, right? And that was extra tough. So we've always had, you know, faculty or international faculty. When you're locked down, you don't have choices. And so trying to figure out how to get camera crews to people at remote locations where they don't have strong internet, finding out that as amazing as injectors as they are, they might not be the most sophisticated technology users, and trying to like...
You can say that again twice, yeah, maybe.
So, you know, the challenges of putting on the same type of show for me was actually really interesting because I think the amount of work that we put into it is easily a large multiplier of the previous amount of work you put on a conference. And yet a good lesson for us is that the perception of value is lower. But I would actually challenge, and I think the educational experience might be better. And something, you know, I'm thinking through even personally with conferences in the future, as I think about attending some of these other virtual conferences, is that I can actually see more closer, and maybe even learn more. But I think it was just an interesting thing to get to have interactions both with colleagues and business owners, practice owners, who inevitably were going through really difficult things, trying to figure out how to respond, how to treat everything. And with patients, they're up, you know, they're going through a lot as well. And so you get to bear the brunt of all of that and the uncertainty on the customer experience side and people asking, when are you reopening? How are you reopening? Why aren't you doing this service? Especially when you're interacting across different states, different cities, different regulations. It's really a moving target. And I think that, the weight on the staff is high, right? So, you know, whoever is the end delivering person of customer service, they have to absorb all of that. And the reality is that most of what people are upset about has nothing to do with anything that they're experiencing at that moment. Instead, it's more of a culmination of really the last several months and what people have been living through, which is as varied as it gets. And so, you know, the conference was more difficult than I could have imagined, but, you know, I think that the educational value of it ended up being really exceptional, something I look forward to again in the future. With patients, I think that we're getting a amplification of the holiday season type of emotions, and I don't think that's going to go away. I think we're still seeing layoffs. We're still seeing all of that come out. So I do anticipate a really prolonged, difficult time of expectation management. And, you know, when I think that there's something difficult, I think it's worth training on and talking about and coming up with strategies. It's really hard. I'm sure everybody knows the first time you have somebody who doesn't believe their lips are still there, like a week after they get them done. If it's the first time that you're having that conversation and you've never role played kind of how to deal with it, and you don't know, and you yourself don't know if it's true or not, I think that could be overwhelming. I think that dealing with, incessant like onslaught of difficult thing after difficult thing after difficult thing, I think per day is exhausting. What's interesting for me, though, is those same types of patient interactions that used to be so exhausting for me in the past almost don't faze me at all anymore. I'm probably having more fun treating patients, even with some of them going through difficult times than I've ever had, because none of those things are new, right? That's almost like familiar. It's easier. I've been through all of those situations. I still have the ones that I'm just like, it's not worth spending any more time on. But what I've been really interested in is that I've been able to turn more of them into good experiences. The vast majority, almost all of them, even though they start out somewhat contentious, because I've, gone through the steps and figured out how I manage photos and like show the images and have a conversation and take time with people to help them understand. So while I do think that the world is going to be different and much and very difficult for us, I think that practice, going through it in a non-threatening situation and getting exposure to those types of situations and figuring out what you're going to say, the goal is not to be a scripted robot, but if you have nothing to say, I would rather you have a scripted something to say to take the tension out of that moment, to then transition into something that you're evolving over time with experience.
And as someone who got beaten up over the conference every day for months, multiple times a day, mm-hmm. or a minute, frankly, it does get easier. So those of you who are listening, thinking about, how does this end for me? It's so challenging. I promise you, as you practice it and you keep getting beaten up, I think the cuts hurt less. That sounds really terrible to say, but it is in fact true. And you become more objective with it, I think, as far as, it's not so emotional for you. Well, we are at the end of our time today. Thank you so much for being a guest on For the Record.
Thank you.
And we've had some intense questions today, too, and some heavy topics. So those of you who want to know more about Dr. Harper and what he's doing, give us your Instagram handle.
So Juvly_aesthetics, and then personal is Dr. Justin Harper.
And also you can join him at training events across the country and conferences, too. Mm-hmm. We tend to hit the circuit, if you will. And also, if you're thinking about what happens post-COVID, do you want more information about how we can help you with it, software, technology perspective, let us know at the Aesthetic Record Instagram as well. We can get you to Dr. Harper through that methodology as well. But thank you for coming today, for being a guest on For the Record. And for those of you listening, you can catch us in studio on YouTube and watch us with our banter back and forth. Mm-hmm. And we will see you next time with another disruptive thinker who's got some innovative ideas and problem solving for our industry. We'll see you next week.